From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Here in the States, say the name Yotam Ottolenghi, and I suspect your mind goes to eggplant splashed with yogurt, spices, and pomegranate seeds, or an insane cauliflower cake, or maybe a texturally complex salad. But in London, fluffy, multi-hued meringues, plus cakes, tarts, and cookies also beckon through the windows of Ottolenghi's delis. The British Israeli chef has just published a new cookbook with his sweets collaborator, Helen Goh. It's titled just that, Sweet. How lovely to have both of you here.
Thank you.
I think that we in America, we have such a skewed vision of what Ottolenghi is, both the person and the business, because of the fact that we don't have access to your work, your actual daily work. We have the books, which are a refracted view in a way.
Yes. Well, I guess that's true. I mean, people who have been in London for the past 15 years, since myself, Sami Tamimi, and a couple of other partners set up the business, would have been able to see, like you hinted, that there is always that kind of savory mountain of food which reflects what's been published in books in the past. Lots of eggplants and butternut squashes and salt dressings from the Middle East and big piles of beautiful vegetables. But there is also another mountain to climb, and that's the dessert mountain. And that's where we have lots of little cakes and big cakes, tarts, all sorts of confectionery items. I mean, it is really almost the same size as the savory side. And it's been our trademark, you know, the desserts, the meringues, the brownies, all the little individual cakes. So over the years, people knew or come to know Ottolenghi is the place that offers really good stuff on the savory side and really equally good stuff on the sweet side.
Which is unusual, I think. So Helen, tell me, how did you become part of this empire of deliciousness?
I was living in Australia and I was moving to London to be with my now husband. And I thought actually when I moved here, I would just have a little break, get to know London. But a friend who has impeccable taste had just been to London and loved Ottolenghi, and she suggested I might want to have a look. Of course, I had a look and was completely seduced by this window of mountains of meringues and salads. And I emailed Yotam and I got a response straight away. And we've been talking since that day, actually.
So were you already working as a pastry person in Australia?
Yes.
What were you doing?
Yes. I mean, I wish I had a very simple answer to that, but I have baked and cooked for a very long time. But in between that, I did actually train as a psychotherapist. But when I came to London, I was hoping to sort of ease into it, whatever that meant.
Okay. So this is fascinating to me because often it seems that it happens more in the sweet kitchen than in the savory kitchen, but you often find people who have this change of career.
Mm-hmm.
That sugar beckons. But to go from that kind of discipline to a discipline where so much of how people respond to the product is linked to so much psychological baggage must be kind of fascinating for you.
Yeah, I must say, in my mind, it's quite split. They're very different strands to me. One's very creative, very practical, very physical in a way, the cooking side. And then the other one is more sort of cerebral, more analytic. Although having said that, Yotam and I, we do analyze cake a lot.
Yeah, I would imagine.
We psychoanalyze cakes.
So talk a little bit about your collaboration, because the best collaborations seem to have a synergy in which each part of the whole brings something different. So Yotam, what does Helen bring to you?
Helen and I are similar in many ways, but for both of us, baking or cooking is a second career. We both did something else, something a bit more of the mind before we ended up in the kitchen. And both of us started in the pastry section. I started as a pastry cook as well. When Helen joined Ottolenghi, I was already working quite a lot with Sami on the savory side and published savory recipes. Helen came and kind of took over the running of the pastry department and really brought a whole lot of different ideas that I haven't known before, haven't been exposed to, because in Australia, they have a different baking tradition that they have in the UK. They've got things that are, first of all, just different cakes and pastries, you know, things like the yo-yo biscuits that we have there. There are particular short biscuits with a little filling in the middle, things like Anzac cookies, which are oat and dried fruit cookies. There's a whole bunch of things that Helen brought with her from Australia, but also things that belong to her Asian heritage, because Helen's background is from Malaysia before she moved to Australia. So she came and brought her own personal biography in terms of cakes, but also her style, which is, like we said, I mean, it's something that is hard to put down, but Helen is a real perfectionist. I perceive myself as a perfectionist, but she's even, her commitment is even greater than mine. So essentially, when we sit down to talk about cakes or analyze cakes, we go to the tiniest details of that particular cake or biscuit that we're analyzing. And we can spend a lot of time doing that. What she brought into the equation is just that ability for us to talk really in depth about cakes and what makes the perfect cake. And I think kind of that conversation has yielded a lot of delicious things over the years.
I think it's so important to have a companion in the kitchen who is one's intellectual equal. So when you're getting crazy, delving into minutiae, they can keep up.
Yes, and not just keep up, but I think no one else tolerates the sense of the sense of detail that I like to go into.
Yeah, and it is true because when we worked on this book, which is essentially this book, Sweet, has been really 10 years in the making because Helen and I have been working together on Sweets for 10 years, but on the actual book only for the last 2 or 3 years. So when you look at what it really is the result of all these conversations, something like our s'mores cookies, they're very familiar to an American audience, because they know what s'mores is. But in Europe, people don't know what s'mores is. Helen went to San Diego, came back, brought a packet of s'mores, let me try it, and said, let's make an Ottolenghi version of the s'mores.
Which involves peanut butter.
Which involves peanut butter and obviously a marshmallow dipped in chocolate. There's a whole process that goes into them. But essentially, these are the kind of conversation. We see something, we spot something, we want to make it our own, either Helen or myself, and then we kind of delve into this world.
I think one of the best things about working with Yotam is that he is very open in a way that you don't have that sense of tradition. So you're open to exploring and you don't mind sort of mucking with other people's traditions. Whereas, the Australians or perhaps even the Americans, you have your s'mores a certain way or your powder puffs a certain way and you want to keep it. But Yotam pushes the envelope and he nudges me to sort of be a bit braver, a bit bolder with the flavors.
And also visually, because in Ottolenghi, the visuals are very important.
Yes.
Sami and I have kind of honed our instincts based on visuals because we are essentially selling food. So the customers come in, they see and they buy what looks great. Helen often comes with something and goes, well, and I tried and I think, oh my God, that's magnificent, but it maybe looks a bit too plain for our display. Mm-hmm. Or people would just pass it by because it doesn't deliver the same fireworks visually. And then we work together on how to upgrade that, how to make it more beautiful, more colorful, a little bit more appealing.
I think one of the things that's great with having written the book is that we were able to include some of those plainer things. We didn't have to dress it up for the sake of it. It could just stand on its own because it tastes great.
Like the spice cake or
spice
the lemon
cake,
poppy
even
cake.
The peanut sandies. There are some things in there that are quite unadorned.
So you said powder puffs, assuming that we would know what that is. First of all, I have to tell you, today is the first time I've seen the actual book. My sitting at home reading has been with the galleys, black and white.
But they don't look that great.
But I have to tell you that even through the black and white, they grab me. So the powder puffs were fascinating to me because I grew up where every recipe sifted flour. And then somewhere along the line, people stop sifting. You start seeing recipes where it's just take a whisk and mix your baking powder and your salt together. So talk to me about how you feel about sifting and describe what these cookies are.
I'm evangelical about it, I have to say.
About sifting.
Well, maybe about other things too, but sifting is one of them. If you're going to go to the trouble of making a cake, and usually for an occasion or people you love, do the best you can. And what's one step of sifting? I just think give it the best shot. I mean, it's really as much to incorporate all the ingredients as it is to aerate the flour.
Evenly. Or
to evenly, exactly. And the powder puffs is one of them where you don't sift once or twice, but three times.
And what kind of sifter are you using? Are you using a Tammy kind of sifter?
What's that?
A wooden ring with a sieve?
We use that for mashing potatoes, it sounds like.
I use
like a handheld, very simple supermarket
sifter.
A sifter, very simple sifter. In fact, they regularly break and I often buy them and I have them in different sizes.
Tell us about the powder puffs.
Oh, the powder puffs. Well, I first ate it. I don't want to give away my age, but I first ate it, I'd say, decades ago. At a funeral in country Victoria, which is sort of outside of Melbourne. And it was a funeral for somebody I didn't know very well. I was accompanying and supporting my partner at the time. And this came to the table and it looked quite ordinary. It looked like a very soft biscuit, But when I had it, I mean, it was a revelation. It was exactly, well, I didn't know the name at the time. What do you imagine a powder puff to taste like? Absolutely ethereally soft, just slightly sweet. It was just magical. And I wondered about the recipe for years. I subsequently broke up with that man, so I had no way of getting the recipe even a year after the funeral. Many years later, I came across an article by one of the best chefs in Australia called Stephanie Alexander. She had a column in the paper, and she had this recipe, and it was called Aunt Peggy's Powder Puffs. Now, as I said, I didn't know the name of the confection at the time, but something about the name Aunt Peggy, Country Victoria, Powder Puffs, the memory of me eating this absolutely divinely soft cake, I thought, this is it. This is the cake I've been dreaming about all these years. And when I made it, under her very strict instructions, one of which was to sift it three times, and the other tip was to not overmix it once you sift it. It was just a fantastic moment of discovering this thing that I'd eaten all those years ago.
And there's a version that's perfect for fall going into winter,
yes,
which is chocolate and chestnut.
Yes, that's right. The first one, as we always with all our products, we otolengicized it by adding raspberry and rose water, which is really lovely. It complements the whole sort of delicateness of it. Then we wanted something more robust, more wintry, not just sort of for the summer. And I think the chestnut and chocolate is just really lovely.
And how do you get the chestnut in there? Is it a paste that you use in the filling?
Yes, we use a paste. What would they call it here? Marron glacé?
Marron glacé. Yeah. Sugar chestnut.
It's a puree, actually. And that's sort of in lieu of the jam that we would use in the traditional version.
Essentially, just to describe it, it's two biscuits that are, when you make them, they dry out quite a bit. But when you've put them together with the jam and the cream, or in this case, chestnuts and cream, you leave it for a few hours. And from something quite dry, like Helen described it so beautifully, it turns into something quite magical, almost like ethereal. You know,
it becomes the three layers all kind of become one. And with the chestnut one, we like to augment things. We like to take things as far as we can, which is to add a little candied chestnut, which is both your tum and I love candied chestnuts. Not everybody does.
Oh, I love them too.
Yes. And we just highlight, accent the powder puff with a little piece of candied chestnut in there as well.
So I don't think it's possible to have a conversation with you about sweets and not talk about meringue. Sorry. But you did put a pavlova on
you
the cover.
There is a meringue on the cover. And it was kind of inevitable in a sense, because I've written the introduction to the book where I introduce Helen to the readers. And I had to mention to remind them, like you said, Evan, you know, that I'm actually originally a pastry chef and not an eggplant chef. The story that I tell in the introduction is that my very first job in the kitchen was in a very highbrow restaurant, a Michelin star restaurant in London in the 1990s. I had no idea what I was doing. I had no experience. The head chef assigned me to work with the pastry chef, and the pastry chef hadn't much to do with me either because I didn't have any experience. So she just said, well, you stand in the corner, and every time I need to make a souffle, you whip up the egg whites for me, make meringue, I'll fold it in, I'll make the souffles, and that would be your job for the evening, which was kind of fine. And I think it seemed completely random that my first job in the kitchen was to make meringues for souffles. But it ended up being something of a God's given, because in a sense, later on, when we started Ottolenghi, we perfected the meringues and they became what you see in the window when you walk into Ottolenghi. And I do love meringues. I mean, I can't possibly eat the whole massive ones that we sell in the shop just like that. But I love them in all sorts of contexts, in pavlovas and in toppings for cakes and tarts. So this book is full of meringues, and even the cover has a fake pistachio pavlova on it.
One of the versions of pavlova that you have in the book that fascinates me is the rolled one. Because it seems like, how do you get it to roll without it completely falling apart?
This is a really great one. It's the one we've been demonstrating along this book tour all the time, because it's a very effective dessert. Essentially, you turn your meringue into a sponge that you can roll as a roulade. First of all, we add corn flour and vinegar to the mix, which people who have made pavlova before knows it guarantees that the center will never quite cook through, and you get that kind of fudgy, marshmallowy,
that great chewiness.
Chewy texture. Mm-hmm. So that helps it from solidifying. The other thing has to do with the oven temperature. So we put it in at a quite high oven, about 400, I'd say, and then we let it cook for a much shorter time than you normally cook meringue, only for about half an hour. It gets a crust, but it's not completely dry. And once it's come out of the oven, it is soft enough to fold and it holds itself together a bit counterintuitively, but it really does work. And it's the most wonderful dessert. You prepare your meringue sponge in advance and then you spread it with cream and then you top with any seasonal fruit that you like, from fresh berries in the summer to stone fruit that we have now and then later on poached fruit. And it is one of the most beautiful, wonderful desserts to serve at the end of a meal.
Let's talk for a minute about cakes. When we think about little cakes in America, we tend to focus on the cupcake, which I think is, I know people are going to hate me for saying this, but I think is sort of banal. But you have taken this idea of little cakes to a completely different level. They're different shapes, different textures. Some are iced, some are diced.
What's really lovely about little cake is because of the size, you can add a lot of richness to them. So we use a lot of brown butter, a lot of ground nuts in it that gives it a moist and rich flavor. We go from madeleines to a Persian love cake, which our customers love.
Financiers.
Blueberry tea cakes.
Yes, the walnut and coffee, little individual cake, the strawberry and vanilla, individual cakes.
I just have to tell you, the way they're looking at each other, it is as if they are describing, I don't know.
They're children.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a love affair of sugar. It's so funny.
Yes, we do tend to do that, I have to say. That is an accurate description. But I think those little cakes... What is so attractive for me, I've always thought about it, is that it all is connected to my sensibility as someone who sells food, you know, when puts food on display. And they are very, very effective visually. When you put a row of little individual cakes, people are immediately drawn to that more than they would if it was just a big cake that's going to be sliced.
It's also not intimidating to eat. You know, like a slab of cake or a big wedge of it can sometimes look a bit intimidating. If it's a small one, you can always put two or three or four away.
Yeah.
You probably end up eating more than that slab.
You probably do, but it's manageable chunks.
So you want to talk about the tin can cake?
The tin can cake. In a way, the texture is somewhat between bread and cake. So it's more like a muffin. It's probably really a muffin in a log shape. It's again draws from traditional Australian, again, the sort of country women's association kind of thing. And it's more of an afternoon treat where I think the Americans call it coffee can cake, right? You have a tradition here that's sort of like coffee can cake. But these are, you used to be able to buy these tins and they're just shaped like a tin can, but perhaps longer so you can get a sort of bigger cake. They're sealed on one side and you fill it in on the open side, having lined it first, and you stand it upright in the oven when it's cooked. And the best way to eat that is to slice them in fairly thick rounds and heavily buttered, like a muffin.
As she said, heavily buttered with a huge smile on her face.
Well, you don't need to, but I like it.
You absolutely need to, I think.
We have this annual pie contest at the station that pits amateur home bakers against pros. We don't separate it. And we get really excited about it. How does the occasion for you dictate the kind of pie? I have to say, I love in the book how you reference people who have been sort of your gurus through cookbooks and recipes, like Rose Levy Berenbaum, the crazy obsessive who has done so much work for all of us.
Exactly. I mean, she says for one of her recipes, in fact, her pound cake recipe, that it took her something like 7 years to get it right. I mean, why would we not use that? And of course, we've sort of otolangicized it by adding cardamom and coffee. But I think also probably from our academic tradition where you reference people, you know, you have an idea, you build on work that's done before, and we see it like a conversation. You have one recipe, you want to add something to it, you take it out of this repository of recipes, you add your bit, put it back into the repository for other people to sort of converse with, whether it's the home cook who wants to put their particular spin on it, or for another cookery writer who wants to do something slightly different to it. And we think of it as a fluid, sort of ongoing thing, which brings it to life a bit.
I love that. It's so true.
Yeah.
So you have to give me something about pie. I can't have you both here and not at least have you say something about pie.
We don't make really, we do on occasion, but the American pies, you know, the one with the crust on top, We don't serve them very often in the shop, and only for one reason, is because you can't see what's inside.
And they don't keep. You have to eat them straight away.
Yeah, and so we've tried over the years, and we have done a couple of apple pies and quince pies, and we've served them in the shop. But essentially, our pies are would be open pies. You could see what's inside. The visual is so important.
So more like a French galette?
We've got a lot of those galettes, and I think those are really great because, yeah, they keep longer. You can see the fruit, you know, like, like most French pies or tarts really show the fruit, even the, you know, very, very dainty one when you brush them with apricot jam. And these are our kind of pies. But what we do love to do with our tarts is, again, give them our little signature touches. So, for instance, we've got two kinds of chocolate tarts. We spread a bit of tahini paste on the bottom. Then we make a sesame brito, which we dot on top. So it's a sesame and chocolate or halva and chocolate tarts. They're individual, they're small, they're very imaginable, and they've got the most incredible nutty, chocolatey kind of flavor. And then there's another one that has rosemary in it, where we put rosemary and hazelnuts in the bottom.
Yes, it has hazelnut brittle on the bottom. It's a baked chocolate mousse.
And we put crystallized rosemary on top.
Yeah, exactly.
And those are kind of our kind of chocolate tarts or pies that we love doing. But when we work with our pies, we change them constantly according to season. Mm. Some would have like a cheesecake filling with cranberries on top. It's coming into winter. Then you can go and do even chocolatey things. Later on, you could have almost a souffle, like semolina filling inside with raspberries when it comes into summer. So we constantly change those fillings like with the seasons.
Because you want those people to come back.
Yes, we do.
Absolutely.
I've been talking to Yotam Olengi and Helen Goh. Together, they've written the book Sweet. Find a recipe for cinnamon pavlova with figs and praline cream on the Good Food blog. Go to blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, it's time for the Jonathan Gold Weekly Restaurant Review. That's when this show continues. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Now it's time to find out where our favorite food critic is eating. That would be Jonathan Gold, of course. He covers the subject for the LA Times. Jonathan, where are you taking us this week?
We're going to San Gabriel, as we do so often. And we're going to a restaurant with maybe the best name of any restaurant I've ever been to.
Which is?
Nothingness.
I love that so much. Does the food evoke the title? Which, that would be kind of sad, actually.
I couldn't figure out why the restaurant is named Nothingness. And I thought it was one of those strange mistranslation things. But no, it actually does seem to say nothingness in Chinese as well as in English.
And what are we eating there?
This is Chongqing-style Sichuan food, which means slightly hotter than the Chengdu style and some different dishes. If you eat here, you know it the next day, but that's fine. Because you get to say that you've been to a restaurant called Nothingness and you've ordered something called Thunderbolt Frog.
Okay, so Thunderbolt Frog is a thunderbolt because it is...
I guess because it's pretty spicy, or maybe because it comes in a big hot pot type thing, or maybe because of the particular piquancy of the chili broth. It's basically a frog hot potty sort of thing, and it's delicious. There's something on the menu called the number one chili oil fish fillet, which is, in fact, one of their fish dishes that isn't a fillet, it's a whole fish, that comes in chili oil. It's very close to the thing that you sometimes see on Sichuan menus is water-boiled fish.
Is there an outrageous amount of bean sprouts in there, too?
There are always a lot of bean sprouts in
there. It's my favorite thing.
A, you eat them, but B, I think it serves the purpose of pushing the fish up to the top of the pot so you can see it.
Definitely.
There's a structural purpose to it. And the third evocatively named dish is brainstorming.
All right.
Which turns out to actually be a whole pig brain in a lot of chili and cumin. So I'm not going to tell you about that one.
Does it come intact on the plate or is it in little pieces?
It comes intact on the plate. I got to admit, I didn't order it. I saw it being paraded by. But other things you're going to want, there's something called the luhi fish, which is chunks of fish in a pureed green chili with Sichuan pickle sauce. Their version of the Chongqing dish that everybody wants, which is often translated fried chicken cube with pepper, and I think is called just chicken with hot pepper here, is really good. It's chunks that are, you know, dredged in salt and Sichuan pepper, fried with an astonishing amount of dried Japanese peppers and served on a plate. And you sort of pick out the chicken and you gnaw it off the bone.
Sounds wonderful.
It's good and crunchy and happy.
Jonathan Gold is the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Nothingness Restaurant in San Gabriel. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations.
Well, the cakes would have been for special occasions, so they would have been ginormous to start with, like a British Great Cake or Election Cake when Election Day was a holiday.
That's Linda Civitello talking about cakes before the invention of baking powder. In her latest book, Baking Powder Wars, she walks us through how this seemingly innocuous white powder transformed life in the kitchen.
So it was essentially a yeast bread that was all decked out with, instead of the daily bread ingredients of flour, water, salt, and yeast, you would have the additions of butter, sugar, eggs, milk or alcohol, spices, nuts, raisins, but it was still yeasted. So it was like panettone, and it would have taken the time it takes to make a regular bread, except longer because you'd have to prepare all the other ingredients, including the raisins, which would have had to be stoned. And I've made something like Emily Dickinson's black cake, and it's black from raisins and spices, 5 pounds of raisins. That's a lot of work. So that's the first step.
So when you say stoned, you mean taking out the seeds from a dried grape?
Yes.
And then also flour wasn't necessarily something that you just went to a store and bought and it was just ready for you to throw in a bowl.
Some of the recipes say to put the flour in the oven first because if it's been stored, it might be a little damp. You know, I mean, yes, and sugar sometimes came in a cone. You would have to grate the sugar. So some of the early recipes that say use powdered sugar don't mean confectioner's sugar, which in England is icing sugar, but they just mean make sure your sugar is in a powder form and not in lumps. So you would have to grate it or put it through a sieve. Eggs, some of the recipes say beat to a raging foam. What you would have were the styles of cake or like panettone, babka, kulak, brioche, specialty foods then. But the additional steps to make, for example, a genoise. I mean, if you're beating your eggs for 10 minutes in a stand mixer, what do you think you were doing with your arm? And the recipes say beat for an hour and then in parentheses, have a manservant do this. I mean, this was strenuous labor. So you had sponge cakes that were leavened by beating eggs to a raging foam, or you had yeast risen breads, or you had pound cake.
So let's talk about that yeast, because the yeast, too, was kind of an arduous instrument of leavening.
Yeah, yeast you had to make. We did not have commercial yeast, reliable commercial yeast, until the Fleischmann brothers showed up from Vienna in 1876 at the Centennial in Philadelphia, and the country went crazy over this, although by then there was baking powder everywhere, too. But you made your yeast, and women were the brewers. They used what was at the bottom of the barrel or the foam off the top, or they made something out of hops or potatoes or milk. How do you keep it? I mean, there are directions for washing the bottles. You keep it in, and you made it. It was in a slurry. It was like a sludge because, you know, the recipes call for pints of this stuff.
You'd have to use a lot, and they weren't reliable from one time to the next.
No, because so many vagaries in the air, and how do you keep this other bacteria from the air from getting to it? How do you keep it from losing its potency? Weather, terrible, terrible havoc on yeast, hot, cold, you know, wet, dry. And then some of the skill of the maker, or I don't know, maybe the kids got into it, but just the weather, or I didn't have time to make a new batch. I mean, if you wanted pancakes in the morning, you had to make sure you had yeast or make yeast the day before. Not convenient. And we're all about convenience in America.
Yeah, not convenient. And all of this work at a time when being able to do these things was the mark of a good woman.
Yes. And the pressures, when I speak, I ask how many people bake bread. Very few hands go up. And I say how many people feel guilty. And these are mostly women because you don't bake bread. And they all feel guilty. It's absurd. And you see exactly where it comes from. And in the book, I talk about this. I mean, I have quotes from its ministers, its physicians, its academicians, all male, telling women exactly what you said, which is, you're not a good woman, you're not a good wife, and the knife in the heart to any woman, you're not a good mother because your bread is bad and you're poisoning your family.
Wow. This powder that we all have, these little cans in our house, they're white or they're red. Who was the person who figured it out?
Well, women experimented a lot. Women were looking for shortcuts. And the first time we see it in print is in 1796 in the first cookbook that was written in the United States, Amelia Simmons' American Cookery. And she uses something called pearl ash, which is literally ash, very refined ash. The world went crazy over this. It was like, you know, the leavener heard round the world. And she mentions it very casually. It's in gingerbread. It's in cookies. It's a leavener. So women could make this at home. But again, time-consuming, kettle outside, you know, the weather, the burning down of things. And then women started experimenting with all kinds of things from the pharmacy. And literally, you had to go to the pharmacy to get them. And when I say strange things, I mean like smelling salts. Because ammonia will leaven. There's baker's ammonia. I mean, the drawback is it's ammonia and it smells really bad.
I remember traveling in Greece in the 1970s and going into a bakery early in the morning when they had just taken out a pan of small little cakes. And I wanted to eat one for breakfast. And they're like, no, 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 you can't have it yet. And I couldn't understand why I had to wait. The baker finally came up to me, broke one in half, and put it up to my nose. And I was just like, how bizarre.
Yeah, you got to wait until the smell dissipates. But who today would, you know, go and open your medicine cabinet and stand there and going, I wonder what Tylenol would do to my muffins. I mean, we're not doing that because we've already got things that work. In England, there was a patent for muriatic acid.
Oh my gosh.
All of these things are really stringent cleansers because this pearl ash, it says, if you mix it with water and it falls on the floor, don't let it stand for any length of time or it will strip the paint off.
Very caustic.
Want seconds with that bread? I mean, you know, that's in your food. The question is, you know, how do we get something that's going to leaven and be easier to work with? The early ones would leave clumps in the food, they, you know, yellow spots. We've all had the, I was too busy to sift the baking soda. And you're just like, oh, dear. And it was way worse with everything they were experimenting with.
This was a job for a chemist, right?
Yes. Finally, the women took it as far as they could, and then industry took over. And chemistry was a new profession then and very, very suspect. You know, it's like Frankenstein. Dr. Frankenstein was a chemist, and chemistry was connected with poison. So what are they about? What are they doing there in their labs?
But finally, a gentleman did manage to make a powder. What was it?
It was made from bones originally. Now it's a mineral that produces the same effect, but he would get tons, literally tons and tons of beef and mutton bones and process them down and pulverize them. His name was Eben Horsford, and he was a professor of chemistry at Harvard. And in 1856, he got a patent for this, and he did it because he wanted to put some of the nutrition back in food, because even then, they knew that flour was being refined and was having some of the nutrients stripped out. So he said, I want to create a leavening agent, and I want to put some nutrition back in the food. But still, you know, you'd have to go to the pharmacy, and it was monocalcium phosphate, and you had a two-headed spoon, and you put some in one side and the other in the other, like a bartender's jigger pony flip, except on a kind of a wooden spoon, because you mixed it with baking soda. You had two leavening agents there, and that was a problem. You still had to go to the pharmacy. You could not combine these two leavening agents in the can, or they would blow the lid off the can. If it was damp out, they would be rendered ineffective. You know, how do you store them? And he finally came up with the solution, which was cornstarch. Add a third ingredient, a buffer, so they don't combine in the can. It'll absorb moisture. It'll work. And once you can combine them, you don't have to sell them at the pharmacy anymore.
Is that why it's called double acting?
Double acting was a brilliant advertising slogan in the 1920s. And the actions, because you have two chemicals, baking soda always, and we all know from our third grade science experiment, you put baking soda in water, it fizzes up, then the cornstarch buffer, and then some kind of an acid. So the first action is when baking soda hits liquid. The second action is when the acid, the other ingredient, hits the heat. And that's what makes us like, look at the oven, let's turn the light on, let's see, oh, look, it's rising, isn't it pretty? Calumet came up with that slogan, and they did it because Royal Baking Powder was their enemy. And I mean, the book is called Baking Powder Wars because these people hated each other. The companies hated each other. The men in charge of them hated each other. The head of Royal said, you know, I'm going to destroy you if it takes my fortune or my life.
So when women were going through this transition from the unpredictability of homemade yeast to a powder, a miracle powder, I would imagine they thought it was.
Yes.
That was being sold to them. Did they have to be led by the hand? Who developed the new recipes? Because all of a sudden, there's a completely different texture of good that is available to us.
Yes. It was a new technology, and women did need to be trained in it, although the ones who'd been experimenting with stuff that stripped the paint off floorboards were, you know, hands-on and raring to go. Several things happened. The cookbooks, we get corporate cookbooks, and there's a major shift. And I enjoyed writing that section a lot when I realized that these early cookbooks that women wrote in the 1830s, even the 18th century up through the 1850s, were about their lives. And they were life advice and moral advice, like don't eat too much cake. It's going to ruin your health. And here, this is a good, you know, a bread for a special occasion. Don't overdo this. Girls don't need to get married right away, and they should learn this. I mean, these were philosophical tracks. Then you get corporate cookbooks. And the point of the corporate cookbook is use our product. Here's how. And here are all these new recipes. And the only sin in a corporate cookbook is using somebody else's product. And you also had women instructing each other. There's a cookbook, the White House cookbook from, I think it's 1888, where she has the recipe using yeast immediately followed by a recipe for the same dish but using baking powder. So you can see they're different amounts, different times, but you see the baking powder is very fast.
Was there also a transition from recipes that are very narrative and inexact and assume a certain amount of talent on the maker to recipes that are more like chemistry recipes?
Yeah, recipes have gone through a lot of incarnations. The early recipes were by weight. They would tell you, like Emily Dickinson's, or 2 pounds of flour, 2 pounds of sugar, 2 pounds of butter, 5 pounds of raisins. So you were expected to have a scale. But as Americans became mobile, we're heading out west, you're not going to carry a scale in a covered wagon, but everybody's got a cup and a spoon. And women were the ones that wanted these new measurements in cup and spoon, which, of course, leads to confusion because your cup or my cup? I mean, how big is the cup and which kind of a spoon? And women had to be trained. All of the cookbooks were very clear when home economists came in and were writing them, level teaspoon. That was a new concept for women because they were used to just spooning things. You see those early cookbooks, they'll give you pounds. And of course, ovens didn't have thermostats until about 1915 in general use. So it's quick oven, slow oven, and instructions on how to tell when that's happening, what that sort of temperature range is. So volume, then cups and spoons. Now we're going back to volume, and not just volume, but grams. And now that I'm doing grams, I don't know how you can bake in anything else.
Linda Civitello is the author of Baking Powder Wars, the cutthroat food fight that revolutionized cooking. After this break, we find out what's in season at the farmers market. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
Yeah, you gotta have the passion. Once you have it,
you never
lose it, yeah.
That's Marcel Vigneron, chef and owner of Wolf Restaurant in West Hollywood, talking to Laura Avery about passion fruit.
I've got a passion for the passion fruit. It's looking really, really nice. It's a perfect season for it. It's just a delicious, underutilized ingredient.
First of all, nobody knows what it is. They look at it.
Right.
It's purple. It's bumpy. Yeah. It's got little dimples all over it. It looks kind of weird. And then it has no smell, so you don't really know what it is. And then how did you find it?
I found it originally on like one of my first trips down to South America, where they call it maracuya. It's yellow down there, and I just kind of like fell in love with the ingredient. And then I came back here and just kind of like have been on the hunt for the passion. When it's ripe, you know, it gets super wrinkly, right? So it looks kind of strange. But when you cut it open, there's that undeniable aroma of just like tropical essence. You know, it's actually technically a berry. So the whole part is, you know, somewhat edible in some way, shape, or form. The flowers in and of themselves are one of the most like gorgeous flowers. You can actually make a tea out of the flowers, and it helps you go to sleep at night. And then the fruit, one of my favorite, most simple things to do is I just scoop it into a little bit of sparkling water with lime juice, and I just drink it.
And the flavor is so intense. Yeah. I mean, I've taken it and I've flavored an entire pint of vanilla ice cream with like one passion fruit.
Right.
Well, what are you making with the passion fruit then today?
So right now we have the passion fruit ice cream. And our ice creams, we do like a higher protein, like less fat. There's no eggs in our ice cream at the restaurant. When I'm freezing them, I would compare it to like a toffee-like consistency. They get really, really stretchy. And I think it's because of the higher protein content. And then it's just a great flavor release. Like when you eat the ice cream, you know, your tongue isn't coated by all the oil or the fat, you know, from the yolks. Mm-hmm. It just really tastes like whatever it's supposed to taste like. So we take our base, which is milk, cream. We have, obviously sugar. We actually use milk powder. Then we do a little bit of glucose and then just a ton of passion fruit.
Yeah.
Right now we're serving it with this lemon yogurt cake, which is really, really dynamite.
Okay, and then the orange, for lack of a better word, slime, I guess it's the fruit, because it's fruit and seeds, that's just all evenly distributed, or is it kind of swirly?
It's kind of swirly.
Ooh,
yeah, it's kind of swirly,
All right, well, that's really great. I love passion fruit too, and the flowers are, Google it, they're so beautiful. You can't even believe it.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you're sharing your passion for passion fruit. This is really great.
Well, thanks for having me, Laura. Yeah, it's been a great time.
So that was Marcel Vigneron, and he is chef owner of Wolf Restaurant on Melrose, and he's spreading the passion fruit love. I'm talking now with Nick Brown, who's a farmer from Rincon del Mar, just south of Santa Barbara. Right now, your table is mounded with passion fruit. Tell us about why you grow it and what's so special about it.
The family's grown passion fruit over a couple different generations, and sometimes it's worked, sometimes it hasn't. I've always liked it. I grew up eating it, and couldn't get enough. I decided to start growing my own plants a couple years ago and leased a couple of acres from my parents, and it was going well, and every little bit that I brought to market would sell out, and people said, oh, is there more? How can we get more? When is it coming? And so I just tried to scale up a little bit, and it's coming in now.
Yeah, and it's a vine, and your ranch, Rincon del Mar, is mostly cherimoya trees, but the passion fruit is a vine, and you're trellising them, so I'm visualizing kind of like a vineyard.
Exactly.
And they're like, what, chest high? You never have to get on a ladder to get these?
No ladder. It's just about chest to head high, and the fruit drops to the ground when it's ready, so there's no actual picking and clipping off the vine, so it's a lot of bending over and harvesting off the ground, but no ladders.
Do you put tarps down to catch it, or it's on the ground? What is it, just lands on the...
It's on straw.
Oh, on straw, okay.
Yeah, just so it doesn't beat up the fruit and damage the fruit visually.
Yeah, and how many of these rows of vines do you have?
So I'm still finishing planting the vineyard, but it's going to be about 4 acres, and the longest row is probably about 200 yards or so.
How many pickers do you employ?
Right now it's just me. you know, sometimes my mom helps out or my sister helps out. When I'm here at market, I have to call in the troops to help me out, but usually it's just myself.
Okay, and how many do you bring to market, say, market today on Wednesday? How many pounds?
So I bring as much as I can fit in my VW Jetta, so it's about 10 boxes, so maybe 300 pounds, give or take.
Okay, and do you refrigerate it?
Never refrigerated. We just get it out of the sun, and currently it sits on my porch in front of my house, and the whole house smells incredible, and I just keep an eye on it right there, and then it comes to market.
And what is the season for these?
So they are just finishing a big bloom, taking a little break, and then there's a big bloom coming on, so that bloom is going to be mid-October, so at 3 months, that's going to give me crop in the wintertime. If we have a nice fall, they'll just continue to bloom, and it won't be box after box after box for 8 months out of the year, but there'll be enough for the table.
All right, Nick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Nick Brown, and he, his dad, his sister, his mom, they all farm up there in Rincon del Mar. They're best known for the cherimoyas they bring in starting in, when are they starting, January?
They'll be here around Thanksgiving, actually.
We'll start with the cherimoyas, and then we have this passion fruit, and let's not forget the pineapple guavas, but we'll talk about those another day. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
We close out the show with a guest DJ set from, are you ready? Wolfgang Puck. Don't turn that dial.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
My mother wanted me to be a musician. That's why she called me Wolfgang. She was in love with Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart.
Okay.
So, unfortunately, I love to listen to music, but I cannot compose anything.
That's Austrian chef Wolfgang Puck. He owns more than 100 restaurants around the world, including Spago here in Beverly Hills. Chef Wolfgang recently made time to talk with Eric J. Lawrence about the songs that have inspired him over the years for our guest DJ project.
Well, let's check out some of the things that you've been listening to.
One song I really remember was from Scott McKenzie, and believe me, that's years and years and years ago, when I was a 16-year-old boy in Austria. Yeah, Scott McKenzie sang this song about San Francisco. Probably was the hippie years and everything. Everybody was smoking dope and being in the street, and love was free. I said, I want to be there too. I want to go to San Francisco. Now, naturally, I was too young to go. I had still to learn. But already at that time, I was dreaming about coming to California. First San Francisco, and then I ended up in L.A. without the hippies and everybody. But I still remember that song, hanging out with my girlfriend in Austria and saying, oh, I will go there one day.
Eventually did come to America, I think, in 73.
Yep.
How much of American culture was present to you in Europe when you were growing up?
Well, you know, I always loved songs from America. I loved American music and also English music. You know, the Rolling Stones, Pink Floyd, and everybody started at that time in the late 60s, early 70s, and so forth. So music was always a big part, and obviously the movies, American movies, you know. So already at that time, I had the dream coming to America and make some money, hopefully. There's a whole generation with a new explanation. People in motion. People in motion. For those who come to San Francisco. Be sure to wear
That was Scott McKenzie with San Francisco. Be sure to wear flowers in your hair. Did you ever manage to wear flowers in your hair?
I didn't wear any flowers, but I put a few flowers in a few girls' hair. So that was it.
Well, what's the next song you got for us?
Well, I have one which I remember really also is a song where I was in Los Angeles already. I had opened Spago already, and it was during the 1984 Olympics here. And Lionel Richie was performing at the closing ceremony of the Olympics. And he was singing that song, you know, to party all night long. And it was amazing because 100,000 people danced to the song. It was like the biggest party. The whole city was so proud that we had the best Olympics ever and so forth. And seeing that, and I remember him saying on stage, you know, 1 billion people are watching us, and let's dance.
Everybody sing, everybody dance. Lose yourself in wild romance. We're going to party, caramba, fiesta, forever. Come on and sing along.
Lionel Richie actually became a very good friend of ours, him and his fiance come to the house, or I cooked at his house, and I love his music, and it's great because he does a lot for charities, and his music really stays on forever. Longevity is really what is important. You know, when you go somewhere where Lionel Richie is playing, you know there's going to be a party, you know you're going to get up and dance. So I think I still love him, and you know, having made songs like that long ago, and they are still played today and still performed today, and he performs everywhere, and it's sold out everywhere. I think it's amazing, so I really respect him.
That was Lionel Richie with All Night Long, as selected by our guest, Wolfgang Puck. What's the next track you got for us?
Well, I think we should go a little back again. One of the first concerts I ever watched was Pink Floyd. Pink Floyd played in Marseille. I was living in South of France, working in Provence. Really, why is that song so important to me? Because I worked at a restaurant called Beaumanière, and that's where I really found my mentor. Without Mr. Tullier, who was at that time 72 years old, I probably wouldn't be a cook today. I might be a truck driver or anything like that, you know, because at 19, I was making more money driving a truck than cooking. But I think, to me, that was such a special place, a three-star restaurant. The chef, who was so passionate about his craft, so inspiring. And then one day, I heard about the Pink Floyd vaguely and the Rolling Stones. They were all starting at that time. And they were playing in Marseille at the Velodrome, which is the soccer stadium. And I never went to a concert like that. And they were playing, and I thought it was one of the most amazing concerts I ever heard. And it was probably the first big concert. You know, I heard the Rolling Stones once in Austria. That was also in the 60s, and I was pissed off at them because they made me wait 2 hours in a standing room only. So I told Mick Jagger that one day. I said, I remember one time when I saw you, I had to wait for 2 hours or longer until they all came on stage. I think they were probably smoking in the back and drinking and having a good time with the girls.
Well, Wolfgang, there are probably many people that have to wait years to even get into your restaurant.
Ah, no, we are easy. They just have to call me and say, oh, I'm a friend of Wolfgang, like everybody does. I love the music of Pink Floyd. So if it's Money or if it's The Wall, I played in our restaurant. And I still remember when I opened Cut in Beverly Hills 10 years ago, Bruce Willis was having a bone-in filet. That's his favorite piece of meat, with a bottle of Vega Sicilia, a very famous Spanish wine. And then he looked really serious, you know, he has this bald head, and says, Wolfgang, come over here. And I said, uh-oh, what did I screw up now? He said, you know what? Having a bone-in filet at Cut, a bottle of Vega Sicilia, and listen to Money from the Pink Floyd is like heaven on earth.
Money! It's a crime.
That was the classic track Money by Pink Floyd. What do you have next for us?
Well, I have another track which really reminds me of my first year in Indianapolis. And Elton John, actually, who became a very good friend of ours and a very good customer, I remember I went to a concert in Indianapolis, and I remember the song The Yellow Brick Road, and that was like the big hit at that time, and obviously, I was falling in love with the girl, and then it's even better. So, but it was my first job in Indianapolis, and I remember we went to a amusement park called King's Island near Cincinnati, and we stayed overnight there and listened to Elton John. So it was really a special experience.
Elton John with Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. So, Chef Puck, your final track is from the Swedish DJ Avicii with a track called Wake Me Up. How did you discover him?
I have to drive my boys to school every day in the morning. My 12-year-old son, Oliver, is a DJ. So he loves music. He makes his own music. He plays as a DJ. I remember we were in Bahrain. They had a DJ, and he wasn't that good. And I put Oliver up on the stage. And everybody from Naomi Campbell to the Crown Prince, they were all dancing and clapping to Oliver as a DJ. Now, it's because of him, I know who Avicii is. I know who David Guetta is, who Calvin Harris is, and I know who Van Buren is. No, you name them, I heard it because of him. If not, I would have still listened to Pink Floyd, you know. So Avicii, I think it's really a great song. And how often did I hear it in my car going to school? Wake Me Up. So that's really a special song which really connects my son Oliver and myself. You know, through music, you connect with many different people, old and young. So wake me up.
That's Wolfgang Puck sharing his favorite tunes with KCRW's Eric J. Lawrence. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen to the show on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also download our show wherever you get your podcasts. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. That's Laryl Garcia, Rosalie Atkinson, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, Michelle Escobar, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more good food.